Welcome, everybody, to the second edition of the Hughes and Hill podcast as a part of Grand Central Magazine. And I'm David Hughes.
And I'm Lawrence Hill.
And Lawrence, we have a number of topics to delve into today. The first one being the story that's pretty much dominated national coverage.
It's all over the place.
Yeah, the last couple days. And that's the Donald Sterling scandal in light of the comments that he made that were privately recorded by his mistress. And it was a lifetime ban for him that Adam Silver put on him today, $2.5 million in fines, and he can no longer be associated with the NBA in any way, shape, or form. And Silver said they can't force him to sell the team, they can't make him sell the team, but if he can get if he gets a 3/4 approval from the owners of the NBA, and Silver did note that he fully expects to get that approval. And all the owners that have came out so far have said that they are fully support what the punishment, and they say that there's no place for it in the game. What are your thoughts on the comments and the punishment?
I thought the punishment was ideal. With comments like that, you would want a lifetime ban. You don't want him to get a year suspension like he just did something small. That's really big comments that he made there. So the lifetime ban was, I feel like, the right decision. The $2.5 million fine was the maximum that they could fine him under NBA rules, so I felt like that was good. Not to sugarcoat it at all and give him the maximum like punishment that he could get for that. I feel like they did a good job there. And also I wanted to say my condolences go out to the Clippers for playing through that situation. Doc Rivers keeping that team together, Chris Paul being the leader of that team and also leader in the Players Association. I feel like they did a good job. They lost the game, but doing the thing with the they turned their workout uniforms out inside out, and then they wore the black wristbands and all that. So I thought that was good to acknowledge the situation but not do too much to make it the main story for them, at least. You know, they're trying to get that championship.
Yeah, it was a tough situation all around, and one that overshadowed what has otherwise been a great NBA playoff. And I think it's probably remedied a bit, hopefully, by the punishment handed down. I think a lot of the guys on the Clippers can probably exhale now and say, okay, let's go get what we've been chasing all year. So I do agree with the punishments. I don't think there's any place for attitudes like that. And not only in the game of basketball, but in life in general and in society today. I mean, the comments, there are things that
you have a lot of material too in our tape.
Stuff and views that you probably haven't heard in years.
Yeah.
An unfortunate situation, and I definitely do think that the punishment fits what Sterling did. Sterling, just a note, he bought the team in 1981 for $12 million. You make it close to $1 billion for the team today. That's what they're estimated to be valued at. So a lot of people are saying it's a win-win for Sterling, but I think, in my opinion, that depends on how much he values being a figurehead of the Clippers.
His image.
How much he values going into those games, and everybody goes, oh, there's the owner, Donald Sterling. So I guess it would depend on how much he enjoyed owning the Clippers. I think he made it clear what his views were, but I don't think that necessarily means he didn't enjoy some of the aspects of owning a team. But nonetheless, there was no place for him anymore in the game of basketball. And I think Adam Silver made a wonderful first impression in the early months of his tenure as NBA commissioner.
That was the right decision, yeah. And talking about those playoffs, though, with that Clippers and Warriors series, you had that controversial call with Chris Paul in game four, I believe, where Chris Paul, I saw it as a foul. He got him on the hip, got him down low on the three-point shot that could have sent him to the line for three free throws. But otherwise, that series has been great. And what other series would you want to talk about?
I think all the series have been great, honestly, except with the exception of Miami and Charlotte. They didn't. And you gotta, when Al Jefferson got hurt, I mean, there went their chances of even taking it to six. Were they going to win the series anyway? No. They might have been able to keep it somewhat competitive had Al Jefferson stayed healthy.
Kimball Walker and Al Jefferson look good.
I think I'm excited with their coach. They have a great head coach in place in Steve Clifford. They'll become the Charlotte Hornets next year, so I'm excited to see the future of that franchise with guys like Kemba Walker, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, Josh McRoberts. He's a guy that has developed into a legitimate NBA player.
Got into a little beef with LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very hard foul. Found him $20,000 for it. I think McRoberts maybe watched too much of the Bad Boys documentary. But yeah, it was a decent season for Charlotte. I don't think anyone expected them to even get that far.
Yeah, how about that Houston-Portland series?
The Houston-Portland series, that's been even probably one of the best, easily. And how about the play of LaMarcus Aldridge? He's not a young player by any means, but I think he's becoming a superstar, at least in the eyes of fans, a lot of general fans who don't get to see Portland all the time being a West Coast team and not always getting the TNT coverage, because I think TNT decides that people would rather see the Los Angeles Lakers run Ryan Kelly and Wesley Johnson out there. But LaMarcus Aldridge, in the playoffs, these are his numbers through four games, 35.3 points per game, 11 rebounds, 2 assists, and 3 blocks. And him and Damian Lillard, I know you mentioned this before the show, the way that Aldridge and Lillard, the big man, little man combo, are outshining James Harden and Dwight Howard.
Yeah.
James Harden is
struggling.
Not only offensively, but his defensive deficiencies have really been exposed.
He's shooting 35%
throughout this series. He's just having trouble staying in front of everybody.
Yeah. That 35% shooting for James Harden, and then him and Howard both getting up to 3.8 turnovers. That's not good offensive efficiency when they're both on the floor. And down the stretch, Lillard and Aldridge have shown to be more effective. So, yeah, I feel like Lillard and Aldridge are really standing out in that series, and they're two young stars in the NBA that we should watch out for. Any other series, though, I'll try to talk about Chicago and Washington. It's been interesting to see how Chicago hasn't been able to get their offense, as we probably expected, with D-Rose being out. But how Washington, down the stretch, you got Bradley Beal hitting big shots. And how do you feel about that?
Washington-Chicago series, I think Chicago's offensive deficiencies have been brought into the light a little bit more as defensive intensity increases in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. But I think Nene and Gortat, they're not superstars by any means, but they've given Washington very, very productive minutes, and they've kind of neutralized the advantage that Chicago theoretically was supposed to have up front. First playoff appearance for John Wall. It's been fun to watch him finally on the big stage. And Bradley Beal has really, really impressed. He had a big game, I believe it was in Game 2, I believe. He's been playing well all series. And those guys, I mean, they already have a really good young backcourt in place that's only going to get better. If they can add about one more piece, that team really has a shot to be a contender in the Eastern Conference going forward. I think they're going to dispose of Chicago, and they should be on to the next round. Maybe the biggest story from a negative perspective is the Indiana Pacers, though.
Oh, yes.
Their poor play from the regular season has absolutely carried over to the postseason. And most notably, Roy Hibbert. Here are his numbers: 4.8 points per game, 3.4 rebounds, and 31 field goal percentage. That's a max player putting up those types of numbers against an Atlanta Hawks team that won 38 games.
Yeah, get the Hawks a little credit, though.
They played well.
They hit 15 threes in game 5. They've been getting shooting from Shelvin Mack, Jeff Teague, Millsap hit a 3, Scott coming in, big man hitting 3. So it's just so many players stretching the floor out, and it's not letting that Pacers D really clamp them down. So the way they're spreading the floor and the way they're playing together and they're playing hungry, they're up 3-2, and they deserve it, I think.
They've played well, and it's been a combination of Atlanta really, really coming to play, and Indiana just they don't look like they're, I don't want to say disinterested, but it's been uninspiring basketball from the Indiana Pacers. And if they do go down to the Hawks, it'll be one of the greatest upsets in NBA playoff history. I think it'll be bigger than that Golden State Dallas one a few years back. And B, I think it'll be interesting to see just what comes of what is going on in that Pacers locker room. We heard about the Evan Turner and Lance Stevenson fight. We heard Roy Hibbert talk about how they're selfish guys in the locker room. Paul George's off-the-court woes have been well-documented on social media with the issue with, all types of issues. But it'll be interesting. It seemed like ever since that GQ photo shoot they did, it's been downhill from there for the Indiana Pacers. They talked about they seemed very determined at the beginning of the year, and it's been troubling, and I know if I was a Pacers fan, it'd be extremely frustrating. And do you think Frank Vogel is potentially on the hot seat?
I think he's gone.
I think it's crazy. But, in the NBA, it's head coach.
Expectations are so high.
Head coaching turnover it runs rampant, and sometimes who lost his job? It was Tyrone Corbin of the Utah Jazz. That boggled my mind. There was no talent on that roster. I don't know what they expected.
There's talk
of
that
him.
Mark Jackson may lose his job if he doesn't get
that's
series with the Clippers.
Also crazy to me. And who are you going to bring in that's going to do a better job? I don't know. He's part of the revitalization there in Golden State.
Great playoffs so far, though.
So, for sure. I look forward to enjoying the rest
great
of them. Moving on, though, switching gears a little bit, the NFL draft. I'm going to talk about from the perspective for the Lions a little bit. Sammy Watkins, definitely a possibility to trade
explosive
up, maybe. But there have been rumblings that they might look to it. It seems to be wishful thinking, though, more so at this point. He has expressed his interest in trying to become a Lion. He's posted Instagram pictures with his name on the back of a Lions jersey and has talked about how cool it would be to play next to Kelvin Johnson. But like I said, it appears to be more of a pipe dream. But a guy that is in the pipe dream is Mike Evans, and I think he would be a nice fit next to Kelvin Johnson. He's not a huge deep threat. He can go down the field and get it, but he's a prototypical possession wide receiver. He would give the Lions a legitimate threat next to Calvin and Golden Tate that have, in my opinion, one of the best wide receiver trios in the league. He'd be a big red zone target to go along with Joe Fourier and, of course, Kelvin Johnson down there. So I wouldn't mind Mike Evans at 10. You talked about how you're very impressed with the receivers in this draft and how deep it is. You want to highlight some of those guys. Yeah.
Considering the Lions, first off, though, considering they got the Tate signing and they'll have him and Calvin Johnson, I don't know if they should go with a receiver first round, but looking at the depth of the receivers in the first and second round range, you got Odell Beckham, Cody Latimer, Marquise Lee, Brandon Cooks, Evans, and Watkins. There's so many explosive receivers that I feel like can contribute day one. So that's definitely a storyline to watch. And I feel like someone in the early second round will get a starting receiver, and the Lions could potentially do that potentially with Marquise Lee if he falls, or Odell Beckham if he falls. So it's a lot of good receivers there.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Outside of Sammy Watkins, because here he appears to be the obvious choice for the guy who's going to project best to the NFL. So I'm going to exclude him from this question. What NFL, what guy, what receiver in the draft do you think will project and have the best career in the NFL if you had to take a pick?
I like Beckham. I like his route running. I like his ability in space. He has punt return experience. I like his ability to go deep. He can run the short routes, line up in the slot. I feel like he's the most versatile, and he has playmaking ability. So I definitely go with Beckham for that. I really love Odell Beckham out of LSU.
Okay, so NFL draft, that's coming up a late one this year. May 5th, it seems like, should have happened already by now. Yeah. But that'll be
looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. I miss the Saturday format. I do miss the Saturday morning format. But they do it at the first round Thursday nights now. So it'll be interesting to see who the Lions get. I think for picking at 10, I think they're a team with a lot of talent. Moving on, though, to CMU football. Spring game was a couple of weeks ago now, and common source of debate that stemmed from that was the quarterback controversy that we now have. Dan Enos, he has said that it's an open battle, with Cooper Rush having the slight edge, mostly due to him having the experience that he obtained last year. But you look at Rush's numbers from last year, he threw for 2,350 yards, 15 touchdowns, 15 interceptions. He'll be a sophomore this year. Cody Kader, the other guy, he won the job last year. He broke his collarbone in the opener at U of M, and his season was ended on that day. So you're Dan Enos. Who are you going with for the opener this year?
I'm going with Kader. I feel like there's a reason he won that job last year, and I think that his mobility and his experience with the program will stand out. I like what we have in Cooper Rush. I like what he can bring as potentially a backup, because you know he can win a game. He's used to the game experience. But I feel like starting off with Kader, because of the mobility and, you know, the experience with the program, I feel like that would be the better choice overall. There's a reason he was, you know, he won the
job. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I wasn't there for those practices, but, I mean, Enos watched these guys every day last summer and in the spring, presumably, as well.
I like the mobility, though.
And, yeah, and he went with Cody Kader until Kader's season, unfortunately, ended against Michigan. But if I'm Dan Enos, I'm going to go with Cooper. Unless the competition is not even close and Cody Kader is clearly the far superior quarterback, I'm going to go with Cooper Rush for a variety of reasons. A, I think he had the team last year. I think the guys would maybe respond to him better. Maybe not respond to him better, but be comfortable with him already.
In the whole season.
Yeah, they bring back guys like Titus Davis, Courtney Williams, as we talked about before in the last podcast. They do return a lot of their skill players. But Cooper Rush is the younger player. He's only going to be a sophomore next year. And although he did throw 15 interceptions last year, he did show a ton of flashes of being a really good MAC quarterback. He obviously has to make adjustments and improvements in regards to his decision-making. He's not very mobile, unfortunately. But I think people say Kader has a stronger arm. I think physically they're both very close. But I'm going with Cooper Rush. I liked what I saw mostly from him last year. People have to remember that was his first true freshman starting. And I think all things considered, he did well. He let him do a .500 record. There were some bad times. There were some good games. But overall, I would go with Rush, unless Cater's so much better that it's hard to ignore. But
we'll see how that turns out, though.
Yeah, I think Enos, he also has to think about keeping his job, of course, too. So it's easier for me to sit here and say, yeah, go with Rush for the future of the program. But Enos has to worry about what's better right now. Yeah. And that can't be understated. More CMU related sports. How about the baseball team? They're not having a bad season at all. 26-18, 12-6 in conference.
Yeah, and I think they're doing pretty solid. They just suffered that sweep to Ball State ahead of them in the conference, so that was rough for them at home too. So yep, that would have been a big series. At least get a couple games, win the series, but not get swept. So mm-hmm, that was rough for them. But we'll see how it turns out going into the Toledo series coming up.
Yep, they have a home series against Toledo this weekend. Toledo is 9-10 in the MAC West. There are a few games under Central Michigan, so Central can either separate themselves this weekend or Toledo can make up some ground for that second place spot in the MAC West. For Detroit-based listeners of our show, the Clash at Comerica is Tuesday, May 13th. They'll play Michigan State at 7:05 p.m. And it's generally a good day for college baseball in the state of Michigan. College baseball in the state of Michigan generally not as recognized, not as
a little under the radar
talked about. Yeah, but that's usually a nice day. Central Michigan, they beat Michigan State earlier in the year. Pretty good baseball team. Maybe we'll get lucky and get to see them play in the college World Series this year.
That'll be a nice sight to see.
That would. That is going to close it for our second edition of the Hughes and Hill podcast. These can be listened to at gcmag.org. I'm David Hughes.
I'm Lawrence Hill.
And thank you for listening.